Thank you. So let me start from the definitions, and then I will not have to worry about this. So a topological group has the Rochlin property. If it admits a dense conjugacy class, so there exists an element G in G with G G, which is G inverse H inverse G H dense, and it has the strong Rochlin property. So this will be strong Rochlin property if there exists G naught. So this is G naught G, such that this is a dense G delta. Subset. So why is it called Rochlin? So I'll just spend, most of you know these things very well, but we have a general audience here. So there is a theorem of lemma of Rochlin, which says that if you have an aperiodic measure space with an action of a measure-preserving invertible map, and it's aperiodic, meaning there are essentially no fixed points or periodic points, then given epsilon and given n, a positive integer, there is a tower. So there exists a set A inside X, of course, measurable, and of course, we can think of this as a unit interval. So we can think of this really as an interval, and the map is just going up. So that's the whole thing, except for we don't say what happens here. At each level, it goes straight up. Here, we don't say what happens. And there is a certain amount of mistakes, which error, which we allow. So every aperiodic transformation has such a picture. It's an easy statement, I mean, easy to prove, but it's very powerful and very fundamental in ergodic theory. It's, I would say, the most basic tool for almost everything. So suppose we have two such things. This is S and this is T, and I draw the same picture. Same n and same epsilon, maybe. And I can also make, of course, this to be exactly the same, because I can just shave them so that they are the same. And then every two intervals are, of course, the same, call it phi. And I extend phi all over this tower. So I actually get, if you will compute it, you can easily see that phi S phi inverse on most of the space is like T. And that just says that, okay, so now a little, one more lemma, the aperiodic transformations in alt mu. This is just the space of all such measures, transformations, is dense. So any two S and P which are aperiodic are almost conjugate. So that means that the orbit of S, if I fix S, is dense among the aperiodic, and hence it's dense in the whole space. And that's the end of the proof that corollary of mu has the Rochlin property. Okay? Does it have the strong Rochlin property? It does not. So there are various ways of seeing this. Constantine mentioned this, one of them. That's perhaps the easiest. This is a theorem of Andres del Junco. T perp, I will not even define it precisely, but this is the set of all S such that S is disjoint from T in the Furstenberg sense. So there is a certain notion of disjointness of two dynamical systems, of two such objects, X mu T and X mu S. They are disjoint if the only way we can join them is by product measure. And so this is the notation, and Del Junco, Andres Del Junco, proved that is dense G delta. Now, suppose we have T, which is strong Rochlin, that is to say, this set is dense G delta. It also must intersect this set, because that's also a dense G delta. So any two intersect, but those sides are invariant under conjugation. So that means T is also is disjoint from itself. And that's an absurd because we always have the diagonal measure which join these two copies of T. So it can never be disjoint from itself. So that shows that this is impossible. No T can be can have a dense G delta orbit. So that's a nice situation. And of course, there is. Now I'm stuck. Yeah, they are entangled, like in quantum theory. So, right. What do I want to say next? So actually, every conjugacy class is meager, and we have a dichotomy. Either every class is meager, or there is one which is big. Okay, actually, there are nice, our motivation perhaps came from a very curious phenomenon. I mean, you would think that if you start with, let G be a countable group. For simplicity, I'll assume that it is torsion-free. You don't need this in some sense, but I'll skip it. And torsion-free. Okay. Then, that's a theorem. Then there exists a countable group H, with G as a subgroup, and such that H has exactly two conjugacy classes. That's quite amazing if you think about it. Of course, one of them is the identity, that's a conjugacy class, and everything else is in one conjugacy class. So you would think that this, if it exists at all, such a thing, it will be very rare, and in some sense it's not. So this exists. We don't know how to use that or to. But the next question we asked ourselves was, I'll talk about works with several groups of people. This particular thing is with Benji, and we also wrote a review article on this subject, which appears somewhere in Colloquium, I think, or something like that. Yeah. And most of what I'm saying here, with the exception of the last part perhaps, appears also there with, of course, many more details. So if you're interested, you can go there. It's on my homepage as well, because Colloquium is not so easily accessible from some places, perhaps. So the question we asked ourselves is it possible to have a group which is locally compact and still has the Rochlin property, and that's possible. So this is a theorem or construction example. So this is myself and Benji. There exists a locally compact group, Polish. Actually, it's a union of compact groups with the Rochlin property. So this was open for quite some time, but it's not very difficult. It's a construction. But it leaves a lot to be done here. I mean, what can you say? What can be the restrictions? Can you actually have a locally compact group which has this situation, where there is only one other conjugacy class, just two conjugacy classes? We don't know that, and that's probably very difficult. But we don't see any obstruction, so it may. Oh, obviously. Yeah, thank you. This is, no, this is, who? That's awful. Whose theorem is that? Yeah, okay. I suggest to invite him here. He's in okay. I'll tell you later, maybe. Right. So, just to tell you about more results, let us say that a compact space has the Rochlin property, or strong Rochlin property, if, now I would like to say the group of homeomorphisms. Has this property. There are some obvious topological obstructions. So let me put here plus. So if the space is not zero dimensional, then the component of the identity, of course, is always invariant and under conjugation. So we cannot hope for more than that. Okay. So then G and I again prove the following theorem. I don't remember years. The following spaces have the Rochlin property. I don't know about the strong Rochlin property. Maybe some of them can be decided, some not. I'll think about it in a minute. But so the Cantor set, and we'll address the question whether it has a strong Rochlin property immediately. The Hilbert cube, there are more things in this list, but let me just mention one more. Now, this is a kind of surprise, a little kind of somewhat surprising result. If you take two-dimensional spheres, so the two-dimensional, even-dimensional spheres, they have the Rochlin property.
You attribute it to
Hickman
9 and 9?
No, read on. Osim, thank you. Dennis Osim. Yeah, the Hingman result is related, but not quite that. What? No. For torsion free, and if it's not, then you can. There is a corresponding statement for groups you're not torsion free. So, okay. Where are we now? Okay, so now let's talk about about the Cantor set. So we said that it had the Rochlin property. How about the strong Rochlin property? Does it have a strong Rochlin property? Now, first of all, let's realize what it says. It says that if you consider the group of homeomorphisms of the Cantor set, then essentially there is only one typical, very typical homeomorphism. And if you want to talk about dynamical properties of the homeomorphism on the Cantor set, if you know just this one explicitly, you know every other thing. And you will see how it comes into the proof in a certain stage. So the theorem is that it is correct. So theorem, and this belongs to Kekris and Rosendahl. And it says that the Cantor set has the strong Rochlin property. That means the group of homeomorphisms has a generic, that's how they call it, a generic element. And they used model theoretical machinery, namely Fries-Hess structures, to prove it. And because they used such abstract machine, they ended up with zero knowledge about what this particular typical homeomorphism is. And they stated that as an open question. And again, this is Benji on work done with Benji Weiss. So I will describe roughly now what this particular homeomorphism is. So we gave another proof that was not using any model theory, but just pointing out explicitly what this is. And I will try to briefly explain what this is. So let's start with the universal adding machine. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm describing to you what a typical homeomorphism of the Cantor set looks like. So this is the inverse limit of V over V n factorial set. It's not unique, but you can use that. That's the inverse limit. So I have this thing. That's one object that I will use. The other is I'll use the Cantor set, not surprisingly, but it will be the classical one. So here it is. I remove the middle third at each stage, and in each of these, we've seen something like that before. In Arkady's talk, so he called it dusty or something. Yeah, mine will be even more dusty because I will take now sequences that converge to the endpoints. Okay, and each of these intervals that are removed in the construction, I will choose two sequences. So if this is the interval J, this will be J minus, this will be J plus. These are the endpoints of the J interval. J's interval, the collection of all intervals will be J. And I will put in each of these a sequence which I will denote by AJN, I guess. In the interval J, it's a double-sided sequence. So when we go to infinity, we tend to this point. When we go to minus infinity, we tend to this point. Now, let's define a transformation. It will be defined on the following space. First of all, the ambient space will be Cantor set times theta union with Z times theta, capital theta. And I will take a certain subset here. And the set will be, this Z will be the following thing. It will be, here I'll take the whole thing. This is containment, it's not part of the set. Here's the whole thing, and here I'm taking the following union, J in J, N in Z, A and J, chi N. Now, chi N is the image of N when I embed Z into this is the compactification, right, of the adding machine, and I denote it by chi. So you see I'm connecting now these two structures, and what I'm getting here is a spiral. So I have here these thetas. They converge to the theta here, but I'm only interested in these points, and they kind of rotate and accumulate along these things, getting closer and closer to the limit adding machine. So this is Z, and now I'll define the transformation. And transformation is easy to write. It's essentially the identity here. So what is T? So T of x and theta is just x and theta plus 1. This is if x is in C. And T P of points of the form A and J, and chi n, this will go to just A, J, n plus 1. And chi n plus 1. So that, this is it, okay? Now, not quite. First of all, I will have to multiply by, this will be the final Cantor set, almost, this z times c, where here I will act by t and here by the identity. Okay? So I have to have this kind of I'll have to have that part. Because you can see that it must be there. But if you think about it, you will see for a minute there is something called chain transitivity or chain relation in a dynamical system. In a general dynamical system, I can go along orbits. That's one way to proceed. I can also go almost along orbits. So I'm at each stage, I allow a certain mistake. So I can jump from here to here, maybe in 10 steps, and then I allow a little epsilon mistake. And then I go on. Now I'm on a different orbit. I go about that for a while, and then I make some error again. So this is chain relation rather than orbit relation. And of course, it's much, I get a much bigger orbit set. But if you consider the transformation that I described here without that part, you will see that it is chain transitive from any two points on this Cantor set. Of course, this is again a Cantor, X is a Cantor set, and I have a homeomorphism of the Cantor set, and that's my candidate, but it's not good. Why? Because it is chain transitive. You can easily see that you can jump from any point to any other point using these little arrows, because the intervals are getting very small, and I can just to make this a kind of small arrows. And you can see that this kind of property is meager among homeomorphisms. So when we got to this, we kind of were confused. But then we realized that the solution will be just to throw every other interval and do the same thing with a set J2. So I keep that one. I mean, I don't do it here, but I do it on the next stage. Then one stage I skip and do it on the other one. And that way I will get a lot of different orbit, almost chain orbits, uncountably many of them. And this is the final transformation. Now the rest is to show that that's the rest of the work is just to show that this is indeed the right thing. So this is another proof of Rosendahl and Kekris theorem, and I will come back to this again later. I think I'm done with that. And with this. And now I am going to talk about projective Friesen limit. So this is due to Irwin and Solesky. And so far nobody really gave, in this conference, gave a definition of this thing. I mean, Slavik talk about this very general things about finite constructions, and from this you could have perhaps deduced some of it, but I will, for the purposes of my talk, I think I'll need to explain this to this general audience again. So here, take a deep breath, because this is going to be a crash course on Friesen limit, if you haven't seen it before. And I'll try to be really very brief. So we have structures. with structures. These are finite collections of structures. You can think of graphs, say, or, yeah, let's be specific on graphs. And and then I want just two properties, P1 and P2. So P1 means, says that for every diagram like that, so these are epimorphisms. Epimorphisms are just maps of graphs, but they should be onto. And of course, they respect the edges and so on. So for any A and B, there exists C and this diagram. Just that. And P2. So now I want for every A, B, and C, so for three graphs, all in K. Now the situation is A, B, with two epimorphisms, C and C. So for every situation like that, I want, or there exist, D, A, B, C, this is the old part, and there is a new part, which completes this diagram in a commutative way. So that's all. Whenever I have such a family, this is a Friese family, and according to Irwin and Selesky, there is now a projective Friese limit. So this is an infinite object. All the objects of K were finite. Now I have an infinite object. It's essentially the inverse limit. There's nothing mysterious about that. So, like we did it here, we have an inverse limit. So there exists, but it's unique, a structure so, I don't know, how should we call it, X, which is in K, in this sense, I mean, it's a graph, if we're talking about graphs, it will be something else, if we're talking about something else, and it's universal, this object is universal. It is compact, zero-dimensional, Hausdorff, of course, such that so first property for every A in K there exists such a map, and second for every finite image, this is just a finite set, there exists an A in K such that, that's a bad place, right? It's infinite. It's a Cantor set. It's a Cantor set. No. The space is will be always the Cantor set.
Element of space is A. It is not something.
It's an abstract. I mean, think of the inverse limit of the finite groups that I had before.
The object is A.
Yeah. So in this situation, we have such a diagram. X, A, F, and F and G. So we can interpolate between these two an object which is in K. So this is just a finite, this is no structure. F, but we can refine it in such a way that so that's 2 and 3. That's the last property. 3 for every diagram of this sort, same A, there exists an automorphism of this structure. This is still a structure. No. Capital F is just a finite set. Not necessarily a structure. But X itself inherits a structure of a graph, if we're talking about graphs. So there exists an F in the group of automorphisms such that this is commutative. So this is the universe. This is the homogeneity, the ultra homogeneity. That's the corresponding object. Okay. So now consider the simplest example you can think about. And I guess that's what Irwin and Solesky thought. I mean, the simplest case you can imagine is a graph. But let's we want to be simple, so we don't want to work with fancy objects, right? So we will work with this. We just work with graphs of this form. What can be simpler than that? And what is an epimorphism? I mean, so if we have two such objects, we can map one onto the other. And what we have to do is to respect the relation. Now, it is permitted to send two of these to one point. But so I can either stay, I can decide to send this here, and now I can send this either here or here or here, and so on. I go on, think of two strings with knots, and you just put the knots on the knots. You can have loops, but you cannot move twice as much as, I mean, just one step at a time at most. And it should be an epimorphism. So we should cover everything here should be covered by something here. This is our category. This is our object here. So it looks like a very naive and simple object. But let's pause for a while and define now, go into kind of abstract topology. I like to teach that in my points of topology courses because it's really an amazing object. So this is the pseudo art. So let's keep here some notes, and so a compact connected metric space is called a continuum. That's a classical thing. And if I take the unit interval, that's certainly a continuum, and I can write it as the union of two intervals, this one and this one. Two continuum, which both are proper. If you cannot do that, then this is called an indecomposable continuum. And if you will think about it, it will be, I guess, a hard exercise, if you haven't seen it before, to construct one like that. How do you do that? You start with a picture like that, 3 points. You take this set in the plane. And now you take a picture like that. You go first here, then here, Then here, and finally here. So you get a picture like that, and you keep doing this. And you take the intersection of all these closed sets, you get some kind of a curve. That's an indecomposable continuum. So this strange object exists, but that's not enough. We want it to be hereditarily. Meaning our space itself is a continuum. It's indecomposable, but also every subcontinuum has the same property. And you have to take this picture and make it much more complicated to obtain that, but it can be obtained. You cannot describe it as a union of two proper subcontinua. And this is the contrived construction that I have here makes it impossible for you to describe it as a union of two proper subcontinua, which is kind of obvious thing in the intervals. I mean, we are used to this kind of things. We cannot, usually don't think about this. Okay. Now, what is a chain-like space? A chain-like space, or a snake-like, is a space that you can cover, a continuum, that you can cover by such open cover of diameter epsilon for every epsilon, and such a cover means that each one of these disks or balls intersect only one neighbor on each side. So just this picture. So of course this is the case here. And then there is an amazing theorem of Bing that says that there is a unique hereditarily indecomposable continuum which is chain-like. You don't know what it is? Here it is. The Fresnel limit of this category, the Fresnel limit of this structure, the projective limit of this, is almost what we want. So I plan to show you, following Irwin and Solesky, why when you climb up to the Fresnel limit, which is denoted usually by this, then the neighboring relation that we have here deteriorates into an equivalence relation. So in the Fresnel limit here, if you have any point x in P, then x can occur for y, at most for one y, which is different from x. So we always have Rxx. So this is our relation of the category, and we apply it, we interpret it in this model, in this infinite model. So the cardinality of such y's is always less than or equal to 2. It's either 1 or 2. And this implies almost immediately that Rp is an equivalence relation. Which, of course, is not the case here. This point is connected to this, it's connected to this, but these two are not. So in each finite graph, it's not true, but here it is an equivalence relation, and you can divide. And then you get the pseudo-arc. So this naive and simple diagram produced suddenly something which is fantastic. I mean, you think it's out of reach, but if you use this picture, it becomes very plausible. So this is P. Of course, we have to use Bing theorem to show that, because we show that the quotient is just satisfy these conditions of Bing. So where am I? When should I stop? 5 more minutes. Okay. So now, first of all, Ola Kwiatkowska showed that if you use certain kind of structures, which I will not describe for good reason that I don't understand yet very well, something imitating the spirals that I described before for the Cantor set. So she used this machinery to define some category K whose inverse limit is the Cantor set, and the object that you get from the transformation that is carried up along the inverse limit is exactly the universal object, the universal homeomorphism of the Cantor set. So this puts this thing in this theorem in this framework, and this gives a third proof kind of. The first Rosendahl and Kekris used the inductive classical Friesel limit. Ours was just with bare hands, we just constructed it, and Ola's is using the dual object, the projective, and I think it's the nicest. And also, of course, it gives the explicit one. The last work that I would like to mention is the work of a student of mine, Izhar Oppenheim, and his work is kind of it consists of some really hard calculations. So Rosendahl and Kekris formulated abstract conditions to decide when a structure like that, they were working in the inductive, in the classical phi setup, and they formulated a condition to decide when the group of the universal object, the Friesel limit of K, has this Rochlin property, so that the homeo or the iso, automorphisms of X, so it's a structure, it has a group of automorphisms, when this has the Rochlin property and when it has the strong Rochlin property, that's the main. These are the two conditions. They have another one, which I will not get into because I'm running out of time. But this can be dualized, and that's what Izhar did. He showed that if you work with dual things, then, and what it is here, in general. So whenever you have a category K, you can consider an associated category KP. And this consists of diagrams. So it consists of diagrams of the following form, M, say, D, and D, two maps. And you look at diagrams like that, and you form a category of this. So the condition will be that this can be this the JAP property. This is joint embedding property. Here it's not embedding, it's the opposite, but never mind. So we have M1, D1, D, yeah, and M2, D2. And if in this category, in KP, this is KP, we start from K, these are objects from K, we take KP, and if we can put here M3, so that, now put your arrows, all of them, well, I will not put all of them, but this diagram should be this on the bottom should be epimorphic images of this. If you can do that, then you have the Rochlin property. Okay, so first of all, he dualized the theorem and he put it in this context, and that's kind of not very hard. And it's but then he tried to apply it to these things. Now you would think that here everything is simple, but it's horrendously difficult. Because if you want to start with two diagrams like that consist of this kind of snakes, and put them together, you will immediately say that it's a hard job. And it involves really very, very, very complicated combinatorial constructions. What he did was to reduce it to the following thing. I'll just say a few, just two words about that. But what he wanted to do is to build a modular structure. So the general one is like that, but he wants one that, I mean, we have this snake above and we have these two snakes below, and that's the most general one. So there are no restrictions. This is an epimorphism, this is an epimorphism. And he wanted to associate with this, each of this structure, forget about the second one, just this one, some kind of a modular one that will be above that. And it will have certain property. For example, he wanted always this point to descend to that one. Okay? And you can do that and many other properties. I will not go into this. But once you have these modular ones, then you can cook up the common extension of the modular ones. And then it gets down to this one. But the really hard work was to construct modular ones like that, so that you can use them as kind of basic building blocks. So this is really a very hard work, but he did that. And so we have now the theorem that the pseudo-arc and what you actually, we were working here in P, right? So everything, the homeomorphisms that we build are in the pre-pseudo-arc. But they must respect R because they are automorphisms. So immediately, the automorphism group of P embeds into, it can be shown that actually it's one-to-one embedding into homeo P in a dense way. And therefore, if this group satisfies the Rochlin property, so does this. And that's what he did. I mean, so the end result is that the final result is that the pseudo arc has the Rochlin property. Of course, you will ask, what about the strong Rochlin property? But unless you have great stamina, then think twice before you try to attack this problem. Take my word for that. Excuse me? I don't know. I don't know. I would guess yes, and perhaps not too hard, but we never looked into that. But my guess is yes. So I'm done.